During the final last months of the narcissistic abuse, I was in trouble, and yet I still couldn't leave. The paralysis I felt was so difficult, so painful, that at times it was palpable. Thank you so much for joining me on Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse. I'm your host, Dr. Carrie Kerr-McAvoy, a mental health specialist with over 20 years of counseling experience and a narcissistic abuse survivor. In this episode, we're going to explore the psychological reinforcement style that abusers use and why victims find it so immobilizing. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. So let's listen in to this replay of a TikTok live. Most of us assume that the purpose of conflict resolution is to actually solve a problem. But did you know for most of us, that is actually not why we get into an argument or have a disagreement, that is not our end goal? That actually our end goal is something else. When I first heard this, it made perfect sense. It was like this light bulb moment for me. I get it. But it's frustrating. Let me explain what happens. So typically, you bring up an issue and you think it's simple, like it's a A, B equals C kind of, or a 1 + 1 problem and we'll get to 2. But you end up discovering that instead, the problem becomes this never-ending circle, this circular kind of fight that we have, and it becomes about who's right or who's accusing who or whose feelings are more valid. It becomes this really bizarre thing instead of just dealing with whatever the problem is. It could be just simply like who's going to pick up the kids today or what do you want to have for dinner or, you know, something really, really simple, but it ends up becoming something totally different. So what happens that makes arguments go awry? Why is it simply a problem-solving situation? Well, one of the things that happens is when we bring up issues, we can't avoid the fact that we're involved, that it's two people talking about something, and generally one of us, maybe both of us, has a sense of accountability for this issue. We feel ownership for it, or we feel like the person's addressing us, not addressing the problem. Say that you're the one who typically picks up the kids after school, and your partner brings up that there's an issue about the way pickups are happening. It's easy for us to infer that they're saying something about the way we're handling pickups. In fact, it just happened to me. My virtual assistant asked me to please stop recording my videos with a little logo in the corner. He wasn't really saying it was good or bad, but he just asked just to have the logo not there. I don't even know why. It could be for a simple editing reason. It could be it's just getting in the way where he wants to put fonts or text or whatever else. I'll tell you, the minute that was said to me, I did feel a little like, wow, I'm doing something wrong. He's making a statement that I'm doing something I shouldn't be doing. And he wasn't doing that. He was just simply probably talking about a design issue. But it felt personal. That's what happens to a lot of us when we bring up issues and why a lot of arguments go wrong. You add in the complexity of the fact that you've got a personality disorder on top of it, or somebody who's a little more fragile with their ego strengths, then you got a real significant problem, because those individuals with personality disorders tend to sort of feel a loss of control, need to so often be right or feel secure or have things just so or whatever their agenda is. So you've got this piece going on. So now that you're sort of upsetting things from that angle, and that makes it really personal. And here's another ironic thing about disagreements. Did you know that the goal often isn't even to solve the problem? The goal for a lot of people when they get into an argument is simply to feel better, not necessarily have a solution. And you know this is happening when they have transferred their upsetness from them to you. So they come home and they're telling you about something went wrong and they're all worked up, and then you start to get worked up and you start to talk to them about it and try to find a better solution. And then now you're a mess, and then suddenly they walk away and everything is just fine. And you're like, what just happened here? Well, for some of us, the reason that we have an argument to begin with is simply we want to feel better. And once we know we've gotten somebody else upset, we feel better. That was the goal, is to create upsetness elsewhere. I don't know if maybe I'm dating myself, but there used to be an old commercial back when I was a kid where This was back when mom stayed home and dad's work, so I'm really dating myself, but it showed a picture of dad getting chewed out by his boss. Then he comes home, he chews his wife out, who feels really upset, who then turns around and scolds the kids, who then the kid goes outside and kicks the dog. You know how you're transferring the pain from one person to the next person to the next person to the next person. So it isn't about necessarily solving something. It's more about just feeling better. Abusers are very good at getting you to cut off, isolate yourself from the rest of your world. They're very good at cutting you away so that only you are in contact with them. And then they do what's called intermittent reinforcement. So there are three different types of reinforcement styles. If you think about how you're going to get behavior, like more behavior of something, they did research on this. You can do it based on a fixed ratio, like every fifth time you'll get a payout. Let's pretend we're at a slot machine, okay? We're in Vegas and we're in a slot machine. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you sat down at a slot machine and you knew every 10th quarter you're going to get a payout? And in fact, you even know what kind of payout it's going to be. It's going to be X amount of dollars. You just put in 10 quarters, you get it. Now, why would Las Vegas do that? Because they'd lose money, right? We'd make sure we gamed it. That's called fixed ratio. Then there's another one called fixed interval. Fixed interval is every length of time, certain amount of interval of time, you get a payout. Again, can you imagine a slot machine? If you would stay on that slot machine and fed it quarters or fed it pennies or dollars or whatever it is, I've never been to one, so I don't know what they take these days, you would get a payout. So say you sat there for a half an hour, you get a payout. Sat there for another half an hour, you get a payout. That's called fixed interval. There is a third type. It's called intermittent reinforcement, intermittent or variable ratio. What that is that it's based upon some variable. It's never the same. It may be in a certain number or it may be a certain interval of time. And then the payout is variable. You don't know how big. It could be a dollar this time. Maybe it's going to be a million the next time. They found when they did this to rats in the lab, that rats just go nuts on a variable ratio into reinforcement schedule. Well, we know that intuitively. It kind of makes sense, right? I mean, a great way to really get your kids to do something or to get somebody to do something is never quite know what the payout is going to be and when it is or how much it's going to be. Well, abusers do that. They use that during the love bombing phase. They also do it throughout the relationship. They use this intermittent ratio as a response, as a way to bind you to them. So you never know when they're gonna show up or how well they're gonna show up. In the beginning, they show up fantastic. So you assume and you hope that the payouts will be the same, but that's why we call it breadcrumbing that doesn't. Generally, over time, the payouts get smaller and smaller, unless they notice they're losing you. And if they're losing you and they feel you withdrawing or disappearing, then they're going to suddenly show up in a big way because they want to pull you back in. They're very good at this. They're like, I got to hear a psychologist who studied personality disorders, does a lot of research on it. He said they have almost a reptilian instinct. So like predator, like honed hunter instinct and the ability to know how just to keep us in these relationships.
Have you considered having a one-on-one session with me in person? Maybe you'd like to have a clarity appointment. I'm offering 15 and 30 minute sessions at the upcoming NARC Avengers Austin meet and greet on the morning of October 15th. I would love to be able to sit down with you, hear more about what you're struggling with, and maybe give you some suggestions. Or maybe you'd like to meet all 10 of the NARC Avengers who are going to be present at the meet and greet. Ask us some questions about narcissistic abuse and our path to recovery. There's going to be a special VIP Q&A 90-minute long forum that afternoon. Be sure to sign up today since seating is limited and pre-registration is required and available through the link in the show notes. How do you move on? He's finally out of our lives. I find myself exhausted and living in fear. It does take time. In the beginning, because of the trauma bond, you feel really shaky, really, really shaky. So let me describe a trauma bond. And this is something I want to do a little more look into it. I really would love to do that because Dr. Mills said something fascinating, and I want to research it to be on solid ground when I talk about it. But I will say what she said, but then let you know that I haven't personally looked into it. She said, I did read, by the way, Patrick Carnes wrote a book called Betrayal Bonds. So there is that book out there, but I want to do a little deeper look into it. But she said a trauma bond occurs with anybody who's gone through an intensely traumatizing event. So say, for example, all of you who've ever been in the military and you've seen actions with your fellow soldiers, you have a trauma bond with all of your fellow soldiers, that you together went through this event as a group, and they've become your brothers and sisters. And you know, you feel like you have this extra special connection. People who've survived a Holocaust would feel the same, that they know they've gone through this really big event and they have this very extra special connection. Now, when it happens with somebody who's abusing us, it gets developed because you're experiencing the trauma of that together. But the problem is that they're the one who's doing it to you. So they're both your comforter, your supporter, who's going through it with you, but they're also the person who's doing the abusing, which is the weird part. So when you leave them, you miss this special connection you have with them, and it feels really awful. It's hard to describe. I mean, I've broken it, so I do know what it feels like. People liken it to a withdrawals from an addiction. I don't really know what withdrawals from addiction feels like, so it's hard for me to sort of use that analogy, but I know the desire to reconnect was through the roof. I mean, sometimes I had to it was a white knuckling it to not reach out and connect. It's horrible. It's horrible. And it lasts for months. I mean, sometimes people have it last for years, but it lasts for at least several months. And it diminishes slowly over time. It's not something that just sort of like disappears. You still get hit with it with waves where you really, really want to connect again. You miss that person, you miss what you shared, but you sort of then have to white knuckle it again through. So through time, it gets less, but you still have, it hits you like ocean waves. It still comes back like ocean waves. So it's very, very hard. So it just takes, unfortunately, it just takes you with holding, reaching out, don't get on their social media profiles, don't reread the text messages with them, don't look at the photographs, please don't contact them. But it's a lot of really, really, really hard work. So that's what a trauma bond is, how to break it. But it is brutal. It is brutal. And that's why people, hoovering is so tempting, because, you know, if you're in one of those throes where you've been thinking about them again, it's very tempting to want to like be pulled back into that again. Yeah, it does. I mean, like I said, I don't have an addiction, so I don't know what that would feel like. But I do know that it's just terribly painful. Here's my question for you. I'm going to put up a TikTok and you'll show up as a reel over on Instagram. But here's my question for you. I had more than one trauma bond. I had a trauma bond with my mom, and I have had one with my sisters, and then I developed one with this ex. When mine broke with my ex, it broke all of them. All the trauma bonds I've had in my life literally broke together. So I don't feel that pull from anybody anymore. It's all gone. I don't have that fear of separation or the feeling fear of fretting or wondering they're okay or feeling really bad. I mean, mine was kind of because I suffered extreme catastrophic level of abuse as a child. My sisters and I did, from an outside family member. It wasn't my parents, but it was an outside family member. We went through that together, so I had this incredible connection with them because we survived it together. But when I broke it with the ex, it broke everywhere. So I would love to know, does that happen to you too? I would really love to know whether or not that happened for you. So I started this whole discussion about this insatiably emotionally hungry person who can't get their needs met. And in the beginning, they don't really realize that, but they know there's something, by the way, they know something's different. They actually would be called, narcissists are considered neurodivergent because their brains look different under imaging. So they would fit into the same way as psychopaths, sociopaths are neurodivergent, autistic people are neurodivergent, and so is ADHD people. So all of us who are neurodivergent, and I use us because I'm autistic, I've known I'm different. I've always known I'm different. I've for the longest time felt like I was an outsider looking on the inside of something. So I could tell everybody else who had knew something or figuring out something that I couldn't seem to figure out. But I didn't know what it was, and I couldn't figure out how to get it. So it was very weird to feel that feeling. So yes, my ex, me being a psychologist, I talked to him, loads about it, what it was like to be him. And he said he knew he was different too. He'd always known that he's been different. And he also suspected he was a narcissist. He bounced that out. We would say that once, bounce that around sometimes out loud. Could I be a narcissist? Am I narcissistic? Why would I answer the question? Because what difference does it make? It doesn't change anything. And I'm not his therapist, so I usually just didn't weigh in there. I just left it alone. To me, it felt like a hop. I knew why I didn't tell him. I didn't want him having one more excuse to blame all his problems onto. Well, I can't help myself. I'm a narcissist. That's what happens is they don't take accountability. They just use these as excuses. So I wasn't going to give him one more reason not to be responsible in the relationship. So I wouldn't say, yes, you are. But I'm thinking inside my head, like, yeah, you are. They're insatiable and it starts to go wrong and they realize they're burning through relationships and they don't really see you as a person. So they don't realize they're burning through people. They're hurting people. They at some point recognize this is harmful. I mean, they have to. And then, that client came into my office and said, what's wrong with me? She recognized something was going wrong, but she wasn't ready to take responsibility because it would take, here's the hard part. And I know we do a lot of like, why are they the way that they are? Are they made? Is it trauma? Is it bad parenting? What caused a narcissist? What goes wrong? Well, it's a complex question. And we don't have a firm answer. We know it's a biosocial problem, meaning there's biological component to it because their brain imaging looks different. But there's also, we know that there's something that happens interpersonally. I was trained under the model of a developmental psychology. So I was trained to think of the self as unfolding from birth into maturity. And that birth, you don't even know that you're a separate person. You see yourself as part of the mother. You're a mother baby dyad. And then slowly you start to recognize that you're a separate person. And that's when separation anxiety pops up and stranger anxiety pops up because you recognize your mom is a specific person or your caretaker, if it's not just your mom. And you also recognize that your caretakers can leave you. And if they leave you, that may lead to your annihilation because you depend on them for everything because you can't even walk or feed yourself. So there's this intense need for the other person to be in a relationship with you. But that's the first time you've even recognized you are a self separate from the person you're in a connection with. And then over time, that continues to unfold as you begin to, the self starts to develop. You recognize you have boundaries, that you have skin, you have feelings that are separate than other people. And you recognize that people may like you or not like you. All of this starts to unpack as your self develops. Well, part of that as it's unpacking is you become aware of shame. Like, wow, I shit my pants and they may hate me for that. What happens if they hate me for that? Are they going to disappear from me? So you end up having this fear of making mistakes or doing things wrong and losing people back to, because if you lose somebody, you're going to be annihilated because you depend on them for all your needs. So shame is wrapped into this problem. And narcissists can't look at shame. Literally, they cannot like tolerate it. It's like oil and water. They just cannot, it's so toxic to them that they can't connect with it. So they avoid it. Well, taking accountability for yourself means you must recognize that you've done something wrong. And part of the experience of when you see that is we all feel a big momentary experience of blast of shame. And we have to know what to do with shame when we feel it, because shame is one of the most powerful emotions we can experience. It's very painful, very toxic to ourselves, and we will do anything to get rid of the feeling. And so if you're not equipped to know how to handle that, then you won't. You'll avoid it. So that then means, if you follow the connection, that we are then avoiding responsibility and accountability because we're avoiding the shame. That's why you see narcissists or people similar on the high end of narcissism not taking accountability and responsibility, because they don't know how to deal with the shame piece of it And they also, at the same time, don't really see you as a person with your own rights, your own needs, your own autonomy. They don't recognize that either because they don't fully see you as a person. So it's very complex. This whole thing's kind of a web of different issues that come in together to make this such a difficult problem, very difficult problem. I hope that long explanation, which kind of trying to tie in different realms of psychology, makes sense. It's hard because we wish there's simple answers. We really do, but there isn't. And here's another thing I want to blow your mind around. I know a lot of people who are cluster B, I know it's even popular on TikTok to say, well, it's because of trauma. Narcissists and people similar to them, people who've had a lot of bad problems in the past, it's the bad childhood is the problem. I'm going to tell you, it's been disproved. It's false. That's not, in fact, for every one of you who've suffered extreme trauma, myself included, it's insulting to us. I'm not narcissistic. I'm not abusive. My empathy is connect fine. It didn't turn me into somebody hurtful, harmful. That theory is called the adverse childhood theory, and it has been disproven. I heard it from Dr. Gregory Lester, who is part of the DSM-5 Personality Disorder Committee. He has research. He has all this data he put out. I even have the articles if you want support for this. I can give you the support for that statement. It is false. False. The reason they do that is because it's always great to excuse your behavior with an outside cause. You don't have to take accountability and you don't have to do anything with yourself if you can say, I can't help myself. Yes? Okay, irregardless of what happens to your life, I could say that. I can't help myself. I was a childhood survivor of extreme abuse. I can't. Yes, I can. It's still my job to get my act together and not harm people despite my childhood. That is not a reason. Or I could say, oh, I walked through this terrible relationship with somebody who probably even was trying to kill me. So therefore, I have a right to go around and step on everybody else. No, I don't. It's my job to get my act together, irregardless of what I experience. That's my job. So trauma is not a good excuse. It's been disproven that it's not related to narcissism. It doesn't cause narcissism. Narcissism is caused for a complex of variety of reasons, and we still don't have final answers on it.
Are you free from a trauma bond? The pain of one can be excruciating, and what makes it worse is the social isolation. Few people know what we've gone through or how to lend support. That's what makes the Toxic Free Relationship Club so special. There, everyone's gone through something just like you. You feel immediately understood. Join today and get 30% off your membership fee for the first 3 months. Thank you so much for joining me here today on this podcast of Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse. It's been wonderful hanging out with you, and I can't wait to see you back on Thursday.